Whenever I have thought of the kidnapping of the young Hurst girl, I have been of one heart and of two minds. My heart aches for a family, for her, but that long, terrible, terrifying wait, for the indecision to pay or not to pay, to promise not to testify against the kidnappers or not to promise. A terrible box in which her family finds itself, where any decision that they may make, any decision, may be the wrong decision, probably is. I don't know how I would react, and I'm sure you don't know how you would react if one of your children, my children, were to be kidnapped. I do know that I appreciate in you the caution of our sages, Al tadin et chavercha ad shetagia limkomo, never judge another until you've actually been in his place. And I do know that whatever happens, whether the girl is released unharmed or is killed, I will never fault the judgment and the decision of the family. For hell has no guideposts. There is no right way. At the same time as my heart aches, my mind is debating two conflicting sets of ideas, contradictory, conflicting, yet I find merit in both. One part of my mind says to me, one ought never to deal with criminals of this type, with kidnappers. It's generally a feckless hope to think one can buy back a loved one by ransom. And this is particularly true, history tells us, experience tells us, when the kidnapping has been highly publicized, has inflamed public opinion, when the kidnappers are sure that they will be relentlessly tracked and tracked down, where they almost always have the feeling that the captive knows something which can trip them up and point to them. So her life is, in a sense, a danger to their survival. And this is particularly true. We look at this thing cold-bloodedly. When the kidnapping is carried on not by the ordinary run of criminals who take a person, snatch a person for money, but by a group of people who live by a certain myth, a certain set of illusions. A criminal at least shares the sensitivities of his society. He knows what a human life is worth. But a band of people who call themselves an army, who believe that they're not involved so much in kidnapping for money as in some kind of sacred act of obedience to a holy cause, such people will have no compunction about killing. For an army is trained to kill. It's his whole reason for being. In a strange, macabre, awful way, the Symbionese Liberation Army holds up to us a mirror of what any army is. Why do so many of these terrorist groups need the term army? Red Army, the Japanese who murdered Lita, and the like. Because an army is trained to kill. An army takes orders. It takes orders from the will of the people. And once the will has been expressed in whatever way it is expressed, it is legal and right to do whatever one is told to do. The Symbionese Liberation Army, so-called, has declared war, revolutionary war, on this country, the capitalist system. And it's interesting, pathologically interesting, that they have framed all that they have done in terms which are borrowed from the military. When the first tape was sent back to the Hearst family, there was sent along with it, or embedded in it, a long, long manifesto. And among the ramblings and the musings in this manifesto were the orders under which the soldiers had acted, their authorization. And I quote, subject, colon, arrest and protective custody and, if necessary, execution. Target, colon, Patricia Campbell Hearst, daughter of Randolph Hearst, corporate enemy of the people, warrant issued by the court of the people. These were soldiers acting under orders, so they felt. The orders come from a sovereign state, a court, the will of the people, their people. And in a strange, terrifying way, this is the way in which society is organized, is it not? We have our armies, and there is some kind of administration or court system which declares war, makes it official, and once it is official, the tacticians, the strategists, the captains, and the generals take over. They have their targets. Nothing must stand in the way. Murder becomes civically necessary act. Nothing must stand in the way of the attainment of the objectives. So in this particular case, using this bizarre, macabre extension of the whole language of statehood, which we take for granted, they added the proviso, this Symbionese Liberation Army, that if any citizen attempts to aid the authorities or to interfere with the implementation of this order, they shall be executed summarily. It's not murder. It's an execution. It's not a kidnapping. It's another act necessary to carry out the objectives of the sovereign will which this group represents. And the problem is, of course, that while we accept the sovereign will of a nation state to do exactly this, we cannot accept the sovereign will of any group of within the state to have the same rights, particularly when this group is a small group of pathologically disturbed people who are trying to achieve their ends at the point of a gun. But I'm fascinated by the image which they have obviously internalized and taken to their own. They are an army. What they're doing is not illegal, it is simply carrying out orders. The orders of some group which has a sovereign will. The man who is quoted on these tapes calls himself a field marshal. Patricia Hearst, in her part of the tape, said that she was being treated as a prisoner of war. And if we accept, as I think we must, the fact that this group accepts the myth of army, sovereign will, state, I think we must accept realistically the fact that this girl has very little chance of coming out alive. Because in the normal state, violence is consecrated by public acts. We send the army down Euclid Avenue, down Fifth Avenue, with thousands of people on both sides of the street with flags and with banners. We give medals and great speeches. And in a sense, psychologically, emotionally, we're telling them, whatever you're sent out to do is right. It's for us. But obviously, an underground army, a revolutionary army, can't parade down the streets, even the streets of San Francisco. It isn't given medals. It consecrates itself through its own acts of violence. Violence is, in the first instance, a proof of its existence. In the second instance, a tying close of the band, the group. They are now consecrated. Blood has been let. They now share a common danger. They are being tracked down. And finally, they're achieving something. They exist. It's only through violence that they exist. Otherwise, they're a figment of someone's perverted imagination. There's no map with Symbion on it. She is a prisoner of war. The only way in which prisoners of war are released is as if there's a ceasefire. And then there's an exchange of prisoners. But obviously, an exchange of prisoners is intolerable. Patricia Hearst is a non-combatant, a child, and the soldiers of the Symbionese Liberation Army who are captured in jail are murderers. They gunned down in cold blood an enemy of the Symbionese Republic. Their enemy happened to be a terrifying soldier, a superintendent of schools, a black superintendent of schools in Oakland, Marcus Ransom. Now, we who live in a fairly reasonable world, who think of ourselves as reasonable human beings, we've looked in vain for some reason for the murder of the superintendent of schools. We can't find any. None has been suggested to us, even though this terrorist army has accepted responsibility for his murder. This very lack of motivation, of reasonable motivation, we must come to grips with. For it suggests what I believe to be the fact that these group of urban terrorists who have come into being here, there, in Uruguay, and the United States, and Italy, and elsewhere, they're not committed to speed up the necessary political and social reconstruction of the world, so much as they are committed to the overthrow of all existing systems. They believe in an ongoing, permanent revolution. And since they are tiny in number, politically impotent, powerless, the only way they can do it is at the muzzle of a gun. The gun must always be out. It matters not so much who the target is as that you select a visible target and you sow confusion and uncertainty, chaos in the ranks of the established. The manifesto which the Symbionese Liberation Army submitted to Mr. Hearst concluded with this motto: to those who would share the hopes and failures of our people, let the voice of their guns express the words freedom. Let the voice of their guns express the words freedom. You may remember a year and a half ago when three Japanese descended from a plane at Lida. And suddenly the Lida airport was filled with machine gun fire and 28 people were killed, most of them Puerto Rican tourists. Two of the three terrorists were shot on the spot. The third survived. And at his trial, he issued a declaration. And when I read the text of the Symbionese declaration, I was reminded of this one, of the other one. Let me read part of it to you. You are either a member of the Red Army, in quotation marks, or a bourgeois. I warn the entire world the Red Army will slay anyone who is on the side of the bourgeois. And this is not a joke. Our relations with the PLFP Arabs was just a jumping off point for us to propel ourselves onto the world stage. Japanese soldiers had carried on the attack rather than Arab terrorists because we wanted to be known. We, the Red Army soldiers who have been in the Arab world, do not demand that they be soldiers like us. I take full responsibility for myself and my friends for the killing at the airport. The three of us decided after we die, we want to become three stars in Orion. In Japan, little children are told that after they die, they become stars in the sky. I don't know the customs in other parts of the world, but I believe that some of the people we have killed have become stars. The Revolutionary War will continue, and there will be many more stars. In New York and Washington, the houses of simple folk must be destroyed. That is how they would be able to feel the seeping torrent of world revolution. The gun. Indiscriminate violence, shaking a society to its foundations. It's part of the pathology, part of the appeal for attention, part of the frustration of the unknown, the unseen, the impotent, the powerless against a world which somehow fills them with rage. We must understand this rage and this temptation to violence and this action of these acts which are irrational, violent, because we're dealing here with irrationality and with pathology and not with Robin Hood. You remember about 3 weeks ago in San Francisco, just before there was this kidnapping, there were a series of so-called senseless murders. 5 or 6 people were gunned down suddenly, swiftly, anonymously on the streets. When this whole sad story is unraveled, I will not be surprised if those acts are related to these. Those murders are related to this kidnapping. You remember in Chicago several years ago, the infamous day of rage when suddenly the weathermen exploded, piled into the streets. There was no visible, reasonable focus of their anger. It simply had to be spent, couldn't be controlled anymore. Those who were caught and who spoke only of the need to shake a system to its roots, to pull it down as if it's a house of cards. And this turning to violence as the ultimate action available to those who cannot otherwise see how they can achieve power, achieve fame, achieve some visibility, is a fact of life which unfortunately in our gun-oriented society, in our urban impersonal society, we're going to have to learn to live with and to handle and come to grips with. What these armies do is to attach themselves to a cause, but really their aims go far beyond the cause. The cause is simply window dressing, often it's only public relations. The IRA in Northern Ireland have attached themselves to a cause. The cause is the lack of political privilege of the Roman Catholic majority in Northern Ireland. For the Roman Catholic majority has long since said, we are satisfied with the new arrangements which the Protestant moderates and England has proposed, and the IRA goes on killing. And the Black September attached themselves to a cause, the cause of the Palestinian refugees, but they go on killing indiscriminately, even though there are political solutions at work with making possible the end of that problem. And the Front Populaire de Libération de Québec, the Quebec Liberation Army, still occasionally kills in the name of the deprived French majority of Quebec, even though the majority at the polls have rejected their approach. Violence is an end in itself. The world revolution, some kind of millenarian vision, sees at the souls of these people. Now, this Symbionese Liberation Army attached itself to a cause. The cause is the feeding of the poor in California. And because most of us are shocked that this, the richest country in the world, and California, the richest state in the richest country in the world, should have tens of thousands of people who are without sufficient food, we tend immediately to assume some kind of rational relationship between the army and objectives. But I'd like to suggest that there really is none. What the army has demanded of Hearst is not only $300 million of food, but the overthrow of the entire capitalist system, returning the land to the poor, to the people, the closing of the prisons, etc., etc., etc. A whole list of requirements which would undo and subvert and transform the entire nature of our nation. And obviously, no one can meet these terms. As a matter of fact, the demand for food is really, in terms of their long-term revolutionary aims, counterproductive. The more people you feed, the more people are satisfied, the less will be revolutionaries. But what they're appealing for here is not food, but for attention. They want recruits. They want to gain strength. They want to be seen. What better ploy is there than to have tens of thousands of poor in Oakland storming food stores for food? Suddenly they can picture themselves as Robin Hood and his merry band of men. And this would be a tragedy if we shared in this illusion. And I'd like to point out to you now, historically, where the logic which relates Robin Hood and to these people fails. Robin Hood was an outlaw, and so were his band of merry men of Sherwood Forest. 13th, 14th century England, in the setting of the sagas of Robin Hood, to be an outlaw meant that your name had been brought up in the courts and you had been declared beyond the protection of the law. Out the law. In the northern ridings of England at that time, the sheriff was both the police force, the judge, and the jury. And the problem with the law was the man who was the lawman. If he was just and responsible, the law protected. If he was unjust, the evil sheriff of Nottingham, if he used the law to displace farmers whose lands he wanted to add to his own, to undo weaker lords than himself, the law became an instrument for the destruction of freedom and not for its protection. And it's very clear from these sagas, which are simply popular ballads which come well out of the popular consciousness, it's very clear that any number of sheriffs were evil and rapacious and greedy and cruel. And they forced men into the forests, into outlawry, in free farmers whose lands that they coveted, small lords and small dukes whose power they wanted to break. This is the band from which Robin's group was formed. And when Robin wages war against the rich and the powerful and gives of the booty to the poor, he is simply returning what rightfully belongs to the people, to the people. And all of us who have been raised from childhood on these stories of Robin Hood have an instinctive sense of the justice of his acts. For yes, it is true that anyone who has so much wealth, even today, has either taken advantage, undue advantage, of certain privileges or quirks of the law, or he's been a robber baron, or he has gotten there on the blood and the sweat and the tears of a workforce of the poor. And so there's a kind of rude justice in what a Robin Hood does. We agree with it deep down, most of us. The problem is that we assume that Robin Hood went after anyone who happened to be rich and happened to be powerful. His objectives were simply to return to those who, from whom it had been taken, what had been taken, and that he was looking forward to a time when there'd be a sweeping revolution in England, a juster society. And interestingly, that's not at all the case. What Robin Hood wanted was justice for those who had been unjustly proclaimed outlaw. After he manages to kill the sheriff of Nottingham, the personification of all that's wrong in that society, the king, King Edward, finally makes a procession north in order to reimpose upon the north the authority of the crown, of which the sheriff was the symbol and the authority. And when he gets to the north, towards Sherwood Forest, he hears from a lot of people all kinds of strange things about Robin Hood, that he'd been unjustly declared an outlaw, and so on. Things he had not heard in London town. And he discovers to find out for himself. And according to the old ballad, a forester suggests to the king that he disguise himself as a wealthy prelate, as a wealthy ecclesiastic. The church was another enemy in Robin Hood's day because they were the bankers of the day. They alone had the right to loan money, and they grew rich on the interest that they illegally charged. He dressed himself as a rich prelate, and he went into the forest seeking to be ambushed, to be captured by Robin Hood's men, and so it was. And when he was captured, Robin Hood demanded of this prelate that he give him his money. Instead of having his money hid, as all travelers did in those days, he willingly took out his bags of gold and gave it to Robin Hood. And he said, "My dear sir, do you happen to know where I'll find the man known as Robin Hood? I have a letter from him from the king." There's sudden strange silence among the men clad in green, and finally Robin Hood says to him, "I know of that man, give me the letter." And he hands him the prelate. The king, disguised as a prelate, hands Robin Hood the letter with the royal seal on it, and it's an invitation for Robin Hood to come to dinner at Nottingham with the king. And of course, this scene gives all the actors in it a chance for the villains, the criminals, these outlaws, to protest their loyalty to the king. And the prelate is invited to dinner in Sherwood Forest. In the process of the dinner, all of the merry men, one by one, tell the king of the unjust acts of the sheriff and of his men, what drove them into villainy, into criminality. And the whole scene ends with the king offering Robin Hood not only a pardon, but a place in his house, which Robin Hood accepts, and he becomes a loyal servant again of the king, as in fact he had always been. The legends of Robin Hood ask for justice and complain against men who unjustly use the law for their own advantages. The enemies in these stories are those who unjustly use the law, not the law itself. Robin Hood is not a revolutionary. He believes in the law. He knows that law protects, and in fact, law, good law, makes men free. Without law, there is no freedom. And there is no relationship between the kind of confused revolutionary ideology of this group and others like it, and the kind of concern to right justice, to undo evil men, which lies at the base of the Robin Hood myth. How do you deal with an army whose sovereign will is revolutionary, whose only tactic is the gun, who will gun down anyone, anywhere, as if it grabs a headline, if it gives them power, if it satisfies the need for rage and for anger and for violence which seize in their heart? I'm afraid if we acknowledge the pathology, the only answer is that they must be dealt with harshly. That he who lives by the sword must die by the sword. So one part of my mind says to me that the only way to deal with terrorists is the way the Israelis have dealt with terrorists. If they deal you a blow, you deal them a harder blow. And because the Israelis are known to have guns and to be willing to use them, the Israeli airliners are no longer being hijacked. It's too dangerous. And where in Argentina and in Uruguay, the Tupamaro and other urban guerrillas have been made open as open criminals whom a policeman may shoot down, they have been to a certain degree restrained. Reasonable people don't like to think of such unreasonable solutions, but think about them, I'm afraid we must. At the same time, the other side of my mind says to me, every human life is precious. Everything must be done to save a life. It's a religious virtue among our people to ransom the captive. It's called Pidyon Shvuim. For thousands of years, Jewish communities around the world have raised money to redeem the captive. We have the records of the city of Alexandria in Egypt, which for 1,500 years annually raised a great sum of money to redeem those who had been caught in war and were being sold in the slave markets of the Middle East, those whom pirates have captured and who were being sold as slaves. The great community in Venice maintained a commercial agent on the island of Malta for hundreds of years. Malta was the great slave market in which the Barbary pirates and others like them brought those travelers whom they'd captured and sold them there. And this factor's whole purpose for being was to serve the society for the support of funds for the ransoming of captives raised in Venice. Venice was a great commercial city, and the Jews, like most people there, were engaged in commerce, and there was a certain danger involved in it. And over the years, it developed a whole interesting corpus of law dealing with the ransoming of captives. It was necessary and obligatory upon a community. It took precedence over monies to build a center. It had human life was more important than the building, the raising of these monies. Interestingly, they were also faced with the fact that the pirates soon discovered that Jews were under the obligation to ransom a captive, and so the price of Jewish captives went up and up and up, until finally the rabbis decreed that these people who dealt with the pirates could pay them only the going rate for a slave to free the people. Lest you think this belongs to the dim, dim past, need I remind you that within the last decade, the Jewish communities of the world have paid large sums of money in ransom, first for the Jews of Romania, and now to pay the head tax, the ransom of the Jews of the Soviet Union. And it's interesting how law tends, the problems of the past tend to repeat themselves in the present. The Romanian government 10 years ago began by asking $300-$400 a head. And when they saw that we were willing to pay it, it went up to $1,000 a head, and then to $5,000, and then to $10,000. And the question began, you know, where's the end? And finally, the Jewish agencies dealing with the government had to say, we'll pay at this level and no more, even if it means that for the while, no more come out. As an interesting sidelight, where pirates didn't know Jewish theology, by and large, Jewish slaves were valued as less than non-Jewish slaves. It was a bother to have about your house somebody who observed the Sabbath, for whom you had to keep separate sets of dishes because of kashrut. So by and large, non-Jews didn't buy Jewish slaves. But if the pirate knew that the Jewish community was obliged to buy it, then the price went up and up. It's a mitzvah, a religious obligation then to ransom the captive, to try and buy back life from those who would destroy life or sell life into slavery. And all of us must respond to that need. But these are the two sets of ideas that conflict, argue with each other. I don't know quite how to put them together in any one case. Perhaps I do. Let me suggest to you a solution again from our history. In the 12th century, there was a great sage who was the leader of the Jewish community of the Rhineland in Germany, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. The habit in those days was for the Jewish community to pay a major tax every year to the city of which it was a part, the count, or the lord, or the duke of the city. When a very ambitious and greedy man, Rudolf I, became the emperor of the Habsburg dynasty, he decided that the cities had a good thing going and he wanted to have money flowing into his treasury, so he would impose a tax of his own, a royal tax on these juries, twice, three times the sum which the cities demanded of them. Now, by ancient law, the Jews were obliged only to the city tax. And the community leaders knew that if they had to pay the city tax and this inflated tax, the communities would quickly starve to death. They'd be destroyed. So Meir and others began to prepare for exile, to leave, to go someplace else. And Rudolf I discovered the decision, and he imprisoned Rabbi Meir, and he decided he had a pretty good thing going here, because here was an easy way to collect his tax. The Jews would pay ransom for their most revered sage, their most important leader, and he imposed upon the Jewish community a ransom of 23,000 golden pounds, which was an incredible sum of money in those days. And the communities of Worms and the others began to raise this money. And the rabbi sent them a letter from the citadel saying, never, don't do it. Simply what is happening here is a political ploy. The king has discovered a way to get his taxes without actually getting taxes. You'll ransom me today and you'll have someone else in jail tomorrow whom you'll have to ransom. This is his way of achieving his ends without the law. And rather than give in to the rapacity of the king, Rabbi Meir spent the last 8 years of his life incarcerated in a castle in Bavaria, prisoner. He refused to be freed because he knew that this was a political undertaking, and not simply piracy, criminality. And perhaps what we must face is the fact that when these kinds of violent acts become purely political, when they move from the ordinary criminality which we saw in Atlanta this last week, an ex-criminal deciding that here was a good thing, a quick way to make money, and trying to make it, and we've learned to live with crime over the long, long centuries. When we move from crime to political subversion, to revolution, then perhaps we have to begin to take a harder line. to be willing to sacrifice a life or two in order to sustain any kind of security for the social order. Because it's very clear that if one crime succeeds, 10 will follow in their stead. If one group of the pathological, these people caught up in the fumes of their own revolutionary millenarian dreams, the sovereign state of this or that or the other, find that they can force a great empire, the leader of a great newspaper, a great state, to do their will, you can be sure that others like them will quickly form their armies and do the like. I'm afraid that the answer lies not so much in a desperately needed reconstruction of public welfare, in solving the problems of a society which allows people to go without sufficient food. That's important. The real problem that these particular groups of people face us will not be solved by providing some food, however much that's required, of solving social problems, however urgent that may be. They'll be solved, I'm afraid, only by recognizing the nature of the attack which they mount against the social order. Every time there's been a major political assassination, instinctively I find myself thinking that someone is involved who has a political cause. That's an act of a martyr. But it's never that, or rarely that. When President Kennedy was shot down, we found not a man with a cause, but a little man. Anonymous, unknown, needing to assert himself, able to shake history because a single gun today can shake history. And when Martin Luther King was struck down, I said to myself instinctively, aha, this is the work of some Ku Klux Klanner, some white racist, and instead it was the work of some petty felon for a few dollars or for other reasons, a little man. And when Governor Wallace of Alabama was shot, I said to myself, well, here's the work of somebody on the extreme left attacking a white racist, some black militant. But instead it was a little man. Tiny little man who lived in his own room, surrounded by his own silence and his own homosexuality, needing to strike out in rage against someone of power or authority or notoriety in the world. Such people exist. They can band together. They can devise all manner of manifestos and causes. And because you and I live in a society which refuses to give up its guns, it's very easy for them to get power. And because they have the desperation of their anonymity and of their pathology, they're willing to use those guns to gain fame, notoriety. Whatever the Symbionese Liberation Army may or may not be, 15, 5, 25 people, it has shaken these United States. And that's power. And that's the fame, the power that they seek. I have one heart, I have two minds. I pray, as we all pray, that this young girl will be returned. What more can I share with you? But the fact that we face a serious worldwide problem, and that we must deal with this problem in its own terms. And we cannot deal with it reasonably, because these are essentially unreasonable actions. Will there be an end to it? I don't know. We don't like to think of repression, because repression catches the innocent far more than the guilty. But unfortunately, these people must be stopped, or we will find a greater level of terror in our lives than we have allowed to creep in, I'm afraid, over the last 15 or 20 years or so. Amen.